So we're going to do the community corkboard now. Katie Levine is sitting to my left with her phone in hand, ready to tell us.
Someone, they didn't write their name, but they want to promote their podcast called Superhero Speak. And it's a podcast about comic books and comic book related media. And you can find it at superherospeak.com/WP. And your mom follows them on Twitter, they said, which is at Superhero Speak.
My mom will follow you on Twitter, by the way. If you go to Nerdist Mom, she'll follow you on Twitter.
Welcome to the continued podcast adventures of three opinionated guys with mics and too much free time. Strong enough to stop a speeding movie rumor, more powerful than a bad comic book event. Able to waste hours of time asking stupid questions to people who have better things to do. It's Dave, Ben, and John. It's Superhero Speak.
Hey, everyone. You're listening to Superhero Speak, and I'm your host, Dave.
And John.
And this week, we have a special guest again with us this week. I just said special twice.
Well, he's just that special.
Well, it's also been a last few episodes have been very guest heavy for us. This gentleman has worked for both Marvel and DC. He's a very talented artist. He has also worked for different animations such as Spawn and the Batman Superman cartoon and Batman Beyond and just a load of stuff. He also was my niece's teacher at the Art Institute. So, you know, if she doesn't get a career in art, we can blame him. Oh, so everyone, good.
Excellent start.
Everyone, please welcome Mike Manley to the show. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm fine. Working all day, drawing the next week of the Judge Parker comic strip.
Oh, okay. Is that the one of the ones you do online?
No. Well, you can actually read Judge Parker online at comicskingdom.com.
Okay.
Which is the King Features web portal, which has all of the feature, all the comic strips and all of, I think, all their feature articles and political cartoonists and basically everybody that works for King and everything they produce, you can see online. So. But Judge Parker is still in, I think, over 200 newspapers worldwide. So it's still primarily a print at this point, although, as we know, online is growing with everything. So.
Right. Yes, I was going to say, I don't know who out there still reads print newspapers. John, do you?
What's a newspaper?
Okay. So one of the things, you know, we always like to ask our guests was art always what you wanted to do, and how did you get started?
Well, when I always loved art as a kid. I was very encouraged by my parents and my grandparents. My grandfather was a commercial artist. He would be what you would call now, which is pretty much almost a lost occupation, but he was a display letterer. So back before computers produced almost all the signage, he did hand lettering. He did that, you know, for supermarkets and car dealerships and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I always loved comics and kid. When we moved from Detroit to Ann Arbor, there was a comic store called the Eye of Agamotto, named after the amulet that Doctor Strange has. And
right,
before we moved there, we used to go up and visit all the time, and it was always closed. We used to go up on a Sunday. That's when my dad always had day off. He was a mailman, so Sundays he always had off. But when we moved there, I used to go there all the time, and that's when I pretty much decided that I was like 13. That's when I wanted to be a comic artist, and I wanted to work, you know, for Marvel and DC. I was very serious from that point on. I actually stopped playing sports in high school, I think after 10th grade. And I had, at that time, I went to Huron High in Ann Arbor, and they also had vocational art class, which I don't know whether high schools have now like they used to, but they used to have like auto shop, printing, where you could learn how to run a printing press. And
right,
they had like a commercial art shop. A commercial art class where you learn to do things like paste up and key lining and all that kind of stuff that you did before everything was done with the computer. So, you know, I was learning how to do that, and I actually got a job in a small ad agency when I was 15, and I basically been working in commercial art for the most part, with a few breaks here and there for other odd jobs, since I was 15. So I was very serious. I always tell my students that one of the biggest differences between people trying to get in now and when I was trying to get in, say, in the late 70s, early 80s, is there's a whole industry of how to do comic books, magazines, like the one I do draw. There's colleges that you can go to and take classes. Mm-hmm. You can actually get your master's degree in a couple different places and comics. And back then, you really didn't have any. You know, if you were lucky enough to live in New York or close enough that you could maybe, I think, like Bob Hall had a class. I think John Buscema had a class. The Cuban right. School had just started. And if you, of course, if you had lived close enough, you could have probably, gone up and been maybe one of the crusty bunkers with Neil Adams. And, you know, so there were a few places, but for me being in the Midwest, you know, that was pretty much wasn't an option.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, it sounds like you were also determined at a very early age to do it. So you started working, you know, you said at 15, 16, when did you get into comic books, like get working for comic books?
My first job was doing a backup in Evangeline, and that was in 1984.
Okay.
And then I helped out on Robotech Defenders for DC, and then that led to, of course, since I drew comics, robot comics, when I went to Marvel, they go, oh, you draw Lois, why don't you do the Transformers?
Of course.
I actually had an opportunity to start the fall before that, because I had met Brent Blevins, who was the nephew of a guy who worked at the comic store.
Okay.
So when Brett was moving from Las Vegas to Marvel, he stopped through Ann Arbor and I met him and we became like instant friends. And, I corresponded back and forth with him. And then I drove out to New York in the fall of 1983, went into Marvel and showed my stuff around. And I would have had the opportunity to start working there on some, there were little comics that they inserted in toys. Marvel used to do that sometimes, you know.
Right.
So I had an opportunity to do that. The problem is they wouldn't let me take it back to Ann Arbor. I would have had to stay in New York, and I really didn't have a place to stay in order to be able to do that. So if that had worked out, I actually would have started even a little bit earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's tough, too. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure it was still expensive back then. I know that even to get a studio apartment in New York today is not something that you can probably do on a starting artist salary.
No, I mean, I suppose I could have done something crazy like, you know, stayed in some horrible hotel or something like
right.
that. But if I remember correctly, you know, I'd worked and saved up some money, and then I had enough money, you know, of course, to drive back and forth. But I don't think I had the extra several hundred dollars it probably would have taken to, you know, rent a hotel, you know, and then I would have, I suppose at that time I actually probably could have actually worked in the bullpen, but had a place to crash. And I didn't feel at that point like I could really and probably impose on Brett, although, you know, years later I realized that I could have imposed. But I probably right. could have worked in the bullpen, because a lot of people at that time did work in the bullpen at Marvel.
Okay. So you said trade classes for art in high school. So did you start working right out of high school, or did you go on to college at that point?
I started working in high school.
Oh, okay.
When I graduated from high school, I went to Washtenaw Community College for one semester, but I was really disappointed with taking the classes there. I really wanted to learn essentially what I ended up learning when I went back to the Pennsylvania Academy here starting in 2007. I started taking classes, working my way to my certificate and eventually my master's in painting. But this was, of course, at a point in the early 80s when figuration and representational art was still at its lowest point. So I was seeing, you know, I would go to, you know, my design class and I would like see movies about, Christo, the guy that wraps islands with paper or whatever. And it's like, that's not what I wanted to do at all. I wanted to learn how to draw and paint better. but I wasn't really getting any kind of classes. So I got frustrated and I go, well, I already know how to do the commercial stuff, the stuff that they're, that I'm paying. I already know how to do that. So why am I paying for that? And I dropped out. So I actually, I didn't go back to school in an official capacity until I was 45, and I had already been working in the business about 25 years by then.
Right. And that's actually why I asked, because I know that you're a teacher now and I know education's important to you, but, I do find it fascinating that you worked for 20 years, as an artist, professional artist, and then you decided, I want to go back to school. You know, was it, did you feel like you could just, there was more you needed to learn, or you wanted to learn new techniques? Like what drove you to continue your education at that point?
Well, in 2003, I started teaching at the Delaware College of Art and Design. Started teaching animation classes, you know, storyboarding and figure drawing for animation, figure drawing for illustration. And they also had a fine art, at DCAD. And, I started seeing, you know, these kids painting and everything. And I've always loved illustration. I mean, I've always loved painting. It's something that I always loved all along. But, doing that really sort of scratched my itch to go back and finish my degree in painting. For myself, I wanted to go and become a better painter. And I had still, all along, since I had lived in Philly, I had known people who went to the Pennsylvania Academy, friends of mine, older friends of mine who went there, you know, in the '70s. And I had taken several, continuing education classes. But I decided at, that point, since I was teaching and, you know, a combination of wanting to continue to teach. One of the things about education now is they want everybody to be lawyered up. You know, they want you to all have, you know, if possible, a master's degree, and pretty soon they're going to make everybody get a PhD. Because that's the art of education works. Like once most people, many of the teachers I had didn't have a master's degree. They had a bachelor's, but now they're trying to make everybody get a master's degree. And of course, at certain schools, they're now starting to offer PhDs and studio art, like drawing, painting, sculpting, etc. So I am assuming that down the road, within 10 years, we'll be saying, oh, I know you have a master's degree, but now you need a PhD. I decided I wanted to go back and to become a better painter.
Right. So, all right. And I know I'm jumping around a lot here, but one of the things, I guess it's, I don't know, I don't... I'm trying to decide what you're most known for, because I know you worked on Batman. Starting with issue 500?
Starting with issue 500, I worked on Batman for a year before I quit and moved on. And then so people know me from Night's Quest or whatever, and then people know me from, you know, from Darkhawk. And then in 96, I actually left comics and went into working into animation.
Right. But my question was when, you know, because you had already said you were a fan, went to the comic book shop when you were a kid, decided that's what you wanted to do. And I have to imagine that most kids, you know, oh, one day I'm going to work on Batman. And you get to work on Batman and it's now it's not Batman anymore. It's, you know, it's Azrael and it's the whole, Knight's End storyline. What was it like working on the book at that point?
It was not a lot of fun. I have to be honest. You know, because at that point things had started to change. I was the Batman stuff that I was a fan of as a kid were those, you know, the great Adams O'Neill, stories and then a lot of the great stuff that Jim Aparo did in Detective, and they were mostly, you know, one or two issue, maybe three issue storylines. When I was working in Batman, things were changing a lot in comics, and so basically I had almost no creative input other than drawing the story. They would these conferences and they would work everything out, and then, you know, this would be in this issue of Detective, and so like Graham's drawing something and then I'm drawing something and then Blevins is drawing something, you know, everybody's drawing different things and dovetailing, and so, you know, you'd have to wait for somebody to draw something so you'd have reference or something, and Robin, and then they'd draw something else, you know, so but yeah, no, financially it was the perfect time to do the book, because that was, no one was probably making, you know, the royalties were great on that. So, which, you know, helped pay for school and when I started self-printing my own Action Planet stuff. But creatively, it was very disappointing because I wasn't really able to draw Batman, per se, which is really the reason why I quit. So, you know, when you play with the big toys, they're not really your toys. They just let you play with them, but you have to play with them in the way that they want you to play with, which sometimes works out great and sometimes doesn't work out so great. And the more important the toy, the more difficult that is. More likely that is. So if you're working on Superman and Batman, there's a lot more strings attached to it, a lot more people pushing and pulling and wanting to have control and thinking you should go this way or that way, because those are the characters that make them the most money. If you were working on, you know, a C-level character, you have a lot more creative freedom because it's not the favorite toy.
Right. So and I totally understand that. You're definitely not the first artist who's been on the show who has expressed that. Then you went over to Marvel and worked on Darkhawk. And
well, actually, Darkhawk was before Batman.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah, I did Quasar was the first series I did at Marvel. When I was working on Quasar, which an editor, Howard Mackey, they had developed Darkhawk. They had initially, I think, asked Pat Broderick or somebody else to do it. They weren't happy with what they saw, so Howard asked me. I did some designs, they liked it, and then the next thing, so I left Quasar, I think after what, issue 13 or 14, I can't remember now, and then I went over and worked on Darkhawk from 1 until 25, and then that's when I left Darkhawk, and I basically went from there, that's when I went over to, basically to Archie Goodwin, who I'd gotten to know, to Al Williamson. I went over to and started working on Batman. The first thing I did was actually Legends of the Dark Knight for Archie.
That
led me to working on Batman because I guess Jim Aparo was leaving, or maybe he had been asked to leave. You never know exactly how these things are going.
Right,
you know.
Right.
There was definitely a changing of the guard at that point. And so then I started on Batman. But I was always doing different things in between, you know. I was thinking other stuff. I worked on The Power of Shazam for 25 issues. I think that was actually the last monthly comic I worked on before I went into animation.
Oh, okay. All right. So then I'm sorry, I had that backwards in my head. So going back to Darkhawk, now Tom DeFalco and you are credited as the creators, and like you said, that you created the design for it. One of the things I mean, and I've loved the art on that book, and I think I do have like the first five issues still in my collection. And actually, John was just talking about it before we got online with you because he said he loved the book.
Yeah, I actually have Darkhawk and a bunch of the Impact comic stuff, but Darkhawk and Quasar, I have both of those in my basement right now.
And you should keep them down there. You should keep them there. Don't let them out.
They were good. They were good enough that I remembered them right off the bat when I saw them on the list of stuff that you've done. I remember the covers.
I think the thing about comics in that era, especially I know at Marvel, was they were trying to start doing, like, every month they would launch, I think, a new title. So they had Darkhawk, they had Sleepwalker, they had a bunch of new comics every month. And that was also, now you guys are at that age, where you guys were the last round of regular comic readers who went through the business. And you guys are all probably in your mid-30s now, I'm assuming.
A little older, but yes.
Okay, all right.
A lot older.
Okay, but you guys were the last rung of people to go through, starting in your teens, early 20s, reading comic books regularly. We have not had that feeder band of young readers coming in, because even when I go to a convention now, I never have young readers come up. It's always guys your age come up and say, hey, I remember Darkhawk or Deathlock or, you know, whatever book. I really like his stories. Mm-hmm. And I think that the stories that they're doing now, they're not trying to, you know, they're called banded or extrapolated storytelling or whatever, where they one issue of Darkhawk probably had four issues worth of story in it.
Yeah.
So I think you got a lot more for your bang for your buck, and at the same time, there was less competing for your dollar. Now there's so much competing for people's entertainment dollar. You know, comics is like, comics are $5 now, so, you know. It's not an impulse buy even in that one. So
yeah,
well, there's a lot of different things going on.
Yeah, 90 to 91, 92. That's when they started with the whole, you know, you need to buy these 15 comics to read this one storyline. And by the way, make sure you get the five different covers of each one of those. You know, it got too much. I remember not having enough money to keep up with the storylines anymore, and that's what got me out.
Yeah, and the other thing too is that there was also a lot more editorial pressure on creative people at that time, because the old version of Marvel before version became the version that was bought by what's his name, and then they went bankrupt. The editors also got a incentive at the end of the year based upon how well their line of your particular group of books sold. So that's also why you used to see Wolverine and Punisher and every Spider-Man and everybody's comic, because there was a lot of stuff going on where they say, well, you know, if I could put Wolverine on this on the cover, it'll sell more copies than, you know, if I put Squirrel Girl on the cover.
Yeah. Again with the Squirrel Girl.
Although I think they're gonna probably put Squirrel, well look, nobody thought Rocket Raccoon was a cool thing until they were in Guardians of the Galaxy, and now it's like cool as shit. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
So actually I wanted to also ask about Darkhawk. One of the things I noticed, and I haven't seen this a lot, at least it seems like the majority of the books, or maybe all of them, through 1 through 25, not only are you listed as penciler, you're also inker and cover artist. You don't see that too often, you know, from a lot of, at least you don't see it today anymore at all. And,
I think it depends upon the book, but yeah, okay. You're right. I think DC was more, there have been time periods where I think it was more common to have, say, like in the 70s, Gil Kane do all the covers for a while because, you know, Stan or whoever thought that he did really dynamic covers.
Mm-hmm.
And then the dynamic cover would, you know, pull attention at the newsstand. But I think with the invention of the direct market, the decline of the newsstand, I don't think that they felt like, oh, well, you know, you need a Gil Kane or a dynamic cover in the way they used to do in the old days. Then it became about putting different cover artists on. I mean, I actually objected to that on Batman. Nothing against Kelly Jones, but I remember saying, if I'm drawing Batman, I want to draw the covers for Batman. I don't want Kelly Jones or anybody else drawing the covers on my book. I want to draw the covers on my book. Mm-hmm. And then towards the end, I did start doing it. I clearly remember as a kid buying so many Superman comics that had really awesome Neil Adams covers on them that were like super dramatic. And then I would get them home, you know, and you'd open it up and it would be like, yawn. It would never be exciting as what the cover was. So, I think now because of the way comics are marketed, you know, they will always want to put, you know, Alex Ross or this guy or whatever. That seemed to be like a big craze for a while. But yeah, I don't get it. For me, if I'm doing a comic book, I want to do the cover.
Okay. Well, I mean, I guess that always, to me, that makes more sense, you know, because you know what's in the book. I know a lot of cover artists and, you know, they're just told, here's a general idea of the story, and they might draw something on the cover. It has nothing really that happens in the book, you know. And
that just happened with, I did two issues of Justice League International Convergence, and they had a young guy do the covers for both issues. And I remember him one night emailing me, asking me if I could send him some pages so he could, you know, look at stuff and come up with the covers. And, you know, his covers are okay. They're kind of generic because they don't really relate specifically to any event in the story. Mm-hmm. And it's not like you used to see in the old days, like, you know, somebody is always dying on the cover. You know, how many comics did you read as a kid where somebody is dead? or the Justice League is dead, or Superman is dead, or I remember all those Superboy comics where like he like screwed up and killed his parents or something. You know, you don't have that anymore. So I don't know. The comics are marketed in a different way because they're not marketed to the public; they're marketed to retailers.
Right, right. That's true. And I'm just thinking about. I think the Legion did that a lot too.
Oh yeah.
You know, somebody died or somebody was going to die on the cover.
I mean, that's probably the most common theme of covers is the hero is dying or dead or about to be dead, you know, or somebody's about to deliver the coup de grace, you know?
Yes. And then you read the book and it's like, wait a minute, there were never even any real danger in this one.
right. The guy never was holding him up by his shirt off the edge of a building at all.
So you're working on a monthly book and you're penciling and inking it. Is that did you ever feel any pressure for you know to get stuff done on time, or were you always did you always get in by your deadline? Because I know. We've talked to other artists that have had issues just getting their penciling done on time.
Well, I think, you know, I came up in an era that you were afraid to be late because they would A, give away the inking to somebody else, or B, give away the next issue to somebody else, or C, you might not get another book to draw from. That was the era that I came up with, that you met your deadline. You know, I modeled myself after all the old school artists that I admire, like Adams and Romita and Buscema and Kirby and, you know, all those great guys that I loved so much growing up. And those guys always met their deadlines. I mean, even, you know, Neil Adams is rumored to have been, you know, a guy that kind of pushed the deadlines. But I would say even when I left working on Shazam, DC used to have what they called the hot list, which was your book was on the hot list if you went past 12 weeks from shipping.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's like, you know, that's like 3 months from shipping. When I was finishing this last two convergences, especially the last convergence, we were literally hours, not months, hours away from things not being, you know, they can print so much faster and everything else. So,
right.
You know, there's that whole era of, I think what broke the camel's back, then smashed the camel, and then smashed everything near the camel, was the image guys producing work habitually late, but the retailers took the stuff anyway. And now there really is no fear of people being late. You know, what is it? Those Jim Lee, Frank Miller Batman things, but those things came up like a year or two in between each issue or something like that. I mean, it's really common now for people to just be late. When I started out, if you were late, you know, you got blackballed, and the editors would say, well, don't give that guy work. He can't meet a deadline.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And that's, you know, that's why I ask, because, yeah, I know, I've heard plenty of stories about people getting blackballed in the industry because of lateness. And obviously that's not something you want.
I mean, there was always guys like, there's very few, say, as an example would be, say, somebody like Michael Golden or Art Adams, who do beautiful work, but you never saw them do many monthly series. They might do a mini series or an issue, really awesome issue here or there. I mean, really, you have to, the main thing that happens when you go from being a professional, go to being a professional from being a fan, is you have to produce A and B level work far beyond your comfort range as an artist. And a lot of people's personalities don't jive. They just can't do that. So, I mean, you literally, you know, you work into, I've worked 3 days in a row with no sleep to meet the deadline. I know guys who can't do that or don't want to do that. So, you know,
right.
It's a little different now, but essentially, if you're working on a monthly book, or like I work on Judge Parker, the newspaper strip, it's 365 days a year. There is a new script. There are no repeats. There's no sudden, oh, by the way, here's some Judge Parker strips from, you know, 1957, you know, that doesn't exist. So part of doing this is being able to essentially, you know, be a performer. You've got to perform every day.
Right. So, all right. So I'm moving on a little bit in your career, and I'm sure this is something that John wants to talk about, because he is a huge fan of the Bruce Timm cartoons. How did, How did you get into animation at first?
Well, I think what had happened is my buddy Brett had started doing something, and he'd had contact. And I had started self-publishing stuff for Action, with the Action Planet stuff. And I had sent some stuff and gotten in contact with Bruce and asked him if he wanted to do something. And he said that he didn't have time to do it, but he asked me if I would like to try out storyboarding. And Brett and I both started on the episode of Superman that had Lobo in it.
Okay.
So they sent nice me the, one. So they sent... They sent me the script. They said, he did act one and I did act two, I think. So anyway, they sent me the script. I think at that time I had an audio tape, still had a cassette tape where you could hear the voice actor. Mm-hmm. They sent you, the model sheet and, a couple of samples of other people's storyboards. And it was basically like, go ahead and storyboard this. So, and I was working with, Dan Reba, who gave me, as a director, he gave me like technical pointers on how you mark a board and do camera direction or whatever, but I just hit the ground running from that point on and went in and did storyboards for about 15, 16 years. So.
Cool. So how different is working in animation than comic books in that sense? Like, you're still telling a story through art, but obviously it's not sequential comic book art. It's, animation. So was there a lot big learning curve?
There was a learning curve in the beginning. I think what I have come to realize, I remember talking to Bruce about this, and he told me that in his experience, there's basically you're either a natural and your brain kind of works this way or it doesn't. And I agree, and I can totally see this now because I've actually taught storyboarding for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
And you have what I call the illustrator's brain, or you have like a film brain. And most comic guys cannot do storyboards because they have the illustrator's brain, which is to do really nice, beautiful drawings. And even though you want to do a beautiful, as good a drawing as you can in storyboarding, you're dealing with time in a different way. You're dealing with film language. And film language and comic books do share some things, share some composition, and you deal with time, but there's a lot of things that happen between panels. And then when you're a storyboard artist, you're basically like a film director, combined with being sometimes a background designer, a character designer, and a animator, because you're basically also doing all the key poses for the characters. The animators take your board, blow it up, and then take all the key poses from your drawings as the drawings, the first drawings, or the in-between drawings.
Right, right.
For the characters. So you're also, what they do after you do your storyboard is they actually film it and make an animatic out of it.
Right.
So it's like a crude cartoon timed with the voice track, which then they send overseas now to the animators, because everything is still mostly animated in Korea. So all the shows like Simpsons or whatever, or when I worked on Fairly Odd Parents, or any show I ever worked on, they timed it all out and they send it overseas. So it's also a lot of drawing, and it's also thinking in film language, thinking in timing, which is different than thinking about making a really nice finished drawing. And it's just the way some people's brains work. I think my brain just naturally worked that way. I think Brett's brain naturally worked that way. I've had a few students whose brain worked that way, but the bulk of my students' brains don't work that way. You can learn the mechanics of doing it, but it's almost like you have to really have an instinct for it, because you take something like a script and then you have to turn it into film, just like you take a script and you have to turn it into a comic. I think it's easier for people to turn it into a series of really nicely drawn images than for people to turn it into film. You have to really start to also, I started studying film more. So it works on other levels besides just really nice drawing. And I know a couple other people tried out doing boards, but it's funny because I know a lot of guys that I got to be more in animation. I knew a lot of people in animation who really want to do comics, and then there's a lot of guys in comics who really want to do animation. So it's funny how there's this sort of like desire in both camps to want to do, a little bit of the other thing,
Right, right. It's funny. You had mentioned Fairly Odd Parents, and I know that you worked on it, and now that you've said it, I'm picturing. There was a short video I saw. I think they showed it on Nickelodeon. It was kind of a behind the scenes episode, or like a short behind the scenes thing. And So you had Butch Hartman standing in front of a wall where there were hundreds of pictures posted up, you know, which were, I don't know if it was, that was the storyboard or not, where it was like,
yeah,
you know,
what they would have, if you, some, again, it all depends upon the director or the producers or mm-hmm. the show or whatever, but they would have what they would call they would pitch the board. So you would pin all your stuff up and then you would walk through and it sort of acted out. And that all comes from Disney. Disney was the guy that started doing all that. He would go through right. that after everything else. So you would pitch a board and then people would say, oh, okay, this is working or this is a little unclear or whatever. Then mm-hmm. you would go back and you would like, you know, finish your board up. I never did that because I always lived in Philadelphia. So even when I was actually on staff at Warner Brothers, I never lived in LA. I've done everything from my studio in Philly.
Oh, okay. All right, cool. No, but I mean, but if you see that, you just see how many images that they're working with for a, you know, whatever it is, a 11-minute cartoon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, just sometimes the my storyboard, yeah. Sometimes my storyboards would be the size of a phone book, you know. It would literally be, like, when I worked on Samurai Jack, I think they were, like, well over 300 pages.
Right.
Well, Samurai Jack was amazing. That was just an incredible thing, the way that
I agree. I think that was still the best-looking show on TV. I think what hurt Samurai Jack was the fact that he was not a relatable character. So the stories were too much like Gilligan's Island, where every week Jack would have to say, well, I could use these magic rune stones to go back in time or, you know, save these scientists from dying. Okay, I save the scientists from dying, you know, and then he walks off and he's this very sort of like stoic samurai. So even though I think the shows were great and they were beautiful, I think it's not like, you know, I realized I taught a class for like a little kid. It's 2005, 2006, someone, and they all love SpongeBob. And they could all tell you all this stuff about SpongeBob. And that is a really good show when adults can like it because it has bizarre, weird, subversive things in it on another level. And then, right. like, a little kid can tell you what Squidward's personality is or what Patrick's personality is. And I think that Gendy was successful with that with Dexter.
Oh, right? Yeah.
It was, you know, if Samurai Jack had like a little sidekick that could have carried the emotional part of the show, then you would have had somebody to relate to, except for, you know, the villain Aku, then I think that it might have actually caught on fire a little bit more with younger kids, because in the end, that's what all those studios want. They want like Adventure Time, you know, where they can get like a bajillion dollars from life. You know, people love Adventure Time. All kinds of ages love Adventure Time. Little kids like it. And then like a lot of the kids I know, students in college, they like it too. So, you know, it's there's this whole other side to the business, deals with marketing and all that kind of stuff. It has nothing to do creatively with your job per se, but can greatly affect the outcome of the show that you're working. I remember not too long after I actually started on Superman, they had started airing it on Kids WB, mm-hmm. which doesn't, of course, exist anymore. And I remember there was this, I read somewhere online that they were rumoring that they were going to cancel the show after the first season because it already wasn't pulling the numbers that Batman was. And of course, you know, Batman had already been on several years, and that's, you know, so I remember talking to people at the studio about that. There was a little buzz that was going around. They didn't cancel. They eventually did whatever 65 or whatever the magic number episode is. But that shows you how the world runs. It's like if you immediately don't come out of the block and you're not better than the last show, you know, then they're like, oh, we're going to get rid of the show, you know, which has, you know, a lot more to do with maybe programming and where they put it on, what time they put it on. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. Well, you're going back to the Firefly argument. You know, you could have an amazing work of art that's killed for no other reason than, you know, it didn't make a certain dollar amount on a certain episode, even though if you let it build, it would probably be one of the best things on TV. That happened with all the Bruce Timm cartoons. I mean, they built through like 8 different series all the way up to the Justice League Unlimited, and the storylines that they passed through all those. If they hadn't let it build, it wouldn't have gotten as good as it did.
Well, there were many times along the way that the new, that there were changes in management at Warner Brothers. And there were many times that, like, I remember Batman Beyond as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
So Batman toys were not selling so well. And as I remember, we were between seasons. They basically approached, you know, Deanie and Bruce and those guys and said, well, we want a new Batman show, a younger Batman. And since you guys are here, we'll give you basically, I guess they gave them the first crack at it. They pitched Batman Beyond and they went for it. The toys never sold to the degree that they wanted. So I think that's why the show only lasted so long. And you remember every 3 or 4 years, it's like a new version. There was the Batman where you aimed the toy at the TV and it was supposed to do something that came after mm-hmm. Batman Beyond. Yeah. And then there was the Batman Brave and the Bold, which I did character design on. I mean, there's always a new Batman. Every couple of years, it's a new Batman. Because basically what it comes down to is like, you get a, Kenner wants to sell more toys, so they want a new version of Batman.
Right.
Know? And that, the kind of thing I always explain to the students is that most people don't realize that the only reason why anything on TV exists is so you look at the ads for the cereal and the fruit roll-up. It's not because they want to make these shows. They make the shows so that the advertisers will advertise. And the backwards way that always works is that, like I said, I'm working on a Superman cartoon and I'm having fun, and then I hear this rumor on the internet that they're going to cancel the show because the ratings are so good. So you're thinking like, what? This is crazy. But you know, that's the downside to working in a commercial medium. Well,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And one of the ones that we've talked about on this show a few times, and I think is a great example, is they canceled Young Justice and then gave us Teen Titans Go. And, you know, a lot of older fans were upset when they did that. But then I'm sitting there and my son never watched Young Justice. But he saw Teen Titans Go, and he's like, hey, this is funny. I like this. And he's watching, and I'm like, now I get it. He's the target audience, not me. I'm not buying toys. I'm buying toys for him. So, yeah.
Right. You will never be their audience.
Right.
I remember Invader Zim came out, and it skewed way, that I've heard, so, that it skewed way older. It appealed to kids that were in college, not little kids. Their idea, the way that they sold it to the advertisers, that said, here's a show for kids between, you know, this age and this age. And then when it doesn't, you know, you're buying Skechers or whatever. But, you know, college kids are not buying the shoes where your heels light up or whatever. So when you don't meet that target demographic, then it ends up becoming a problem.
Right.
So,
but that, none of that explains bronies.
Right. So again, you know, there's all these other, you know, there's all these other, I mean, I went through a development thing with a project with Bill Ray. He and I came up with a concept. He pitched it to Nickelodeon. It took us about 3 years to go all the way through the whole development process. In the end, it didn't make it a pilot basically because the guy we were working with, it was ended up being like a bad marriage. He gave us a lot of, I think, bad advice, which sort of changed the nature of the project that we had, but that's the way it goes. It's like so many things like that happen when you're working with animation or you're working with TV that really, you know, have nothing to do with you telling a good story necessarily or make somebody laugh. If the wrong people laugh, then they're like, oh, well, I don't want 40-year-olds watching the show. I want 8-year-olds watching the show. Or I want 8-year-old girls watching the show, not 8-year-old boys. I mean, that's a whole thing. Like, people are upset about there not being enough Black Widow toys. I guarantee you, if Disney felt they could sell $1 billion worth of Black Widow toys, they are a company that would be stuffing them down your throat as soon as you walk out the door. Because that company, of all companies, it's historically the most successful at marketing their product. So if they thought that they could sell Black Widow toys, 12-year-old boys, they would. The fact is they test this stuff, and that 12-year-old boy doesn't want to have a Black Widow. Well, a 12-year-old girl does, but they're not trying to sell boys' toys to girls.
Yeah, and it's funny. We actually haven't talked about it on this show yet, the whole Black Widow thing, but I did do some research, and they did put out a Black Widow figure for Winter Soldier. So my assumption would be that figure didn't sell. So when it came time to do the toys for Age of Ultron, they're like, well, we didn't sell Black Widow figures before, so let's not make her again, you know?
He never put out many with the Batman. What they put out with Catwoman, they put out a Harley, I think, but they hardly ever put out any female characters for any of this stuff. I mean, it's just the way all the stuff is, you know, is marketed. I know people can get, you know, their underwear and a bunch over this stuff, but the fact is that, you know, these corporations are very good at exploiting their demographic. They've spent millions and millions of dollars to research this stuff. So,
right.
You know, if they really felt that there was a huge market for Black Widow toys, they'd be out there, you know?
Right, exactly. I mean, they're not... Oh, go ahead, John.
Well, I just had another question, but...
Go ahead.
Well, so we've been talking about, you know, the downside of that stuff, which is actually quite close to the field that Dave and I are in real life. You know, we kind of have the same problems with, you know, the struggle between doing good and being told what to do and all that. But so let's turn it around and say, so what did you enjoy doing? What place treated you well and that you would go back to or something?
The last show I worked on that I actually enjoyed working on was Secret Saturdays, even though again, that was a show that was sort of failed because the toys didn't sell, but I enjoyed working on that. That show. The nice thing about it is that I was able to turn the storyboard in, and I didn't have a lot of revisions or anything. But so I did enjoy doing that. And you know, the time period working at Marvel, let's say pre-Image, was I think a lot more low key and enjoyable, because once the mega money started coming in, it really changed the way people treated each other to a degree in the business. So, you know, in those days, you could go up to Marvel and you could get a job, you could do this or that. You know, it became increasingly, especially once Image came in and people were making, you know, enough money off of a book to buy a house or a car, that did sort of change things. But, you know, one of the nice things about doing, say, something like Judge Parker, which, you know, is not nearly as exciting, let's say, as something like Batman, but I can practice my craft as a cartoonist, and I don't really have the, very little editorial, interference. Sometimes I've had to redraw the breasts on some of the female characters because they were just too sexy. But and really now I enjoy actually working on my own paintings the most, because I'm only having to feed me, you know. Yeah. It's the nature of comics has changed, the nature of the business has changed. I still enjoy the craft of cartooning, but you know, it's not as smooth. I do have a new comic series for a new publisher that's coming up. I can't give any details about it, but I'm actually very excited about it. I've read the first, the company's called Creative Mind Energy. I've read the first six issues, and it's really good. So I'm very excited about doing that and coming back. And I'm going to do everything, pencil it, ink it, and color it. So I'm really excited about that. That should be coming out sometime next year. I'm about to start working on it this summer. So it's better, I think, in the long run, the way the industry is now, it's better to sort of play with your own toys and do your own thing. I mean, it's fun to draw Batman and Superman, but even if I was drawing Superman now, I can't draw my version of Superman. It's the guy wearing a t-shirt.
Right.
Yeah.
You mentioned Convergence. Are you allowed to talk about it at all?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know anything about it.
Oh, okay.
I mean, the thing was is that I met Marie Javens at UltimateCon last year, and I know Marie from when we used to work back at Marvel in the old days.
Mm-hmm.
And she was also looking for people to jump in on this stuff. So she recommended that particular book, and she thought that it would, you know, maybe might sell really well or whatever. I mean, I'd never read the Justice League.
Right.
You know, I mean, I was aware of the Justice League, but I'd never read any of those issues, so I wasn't a fan of any of that stuff. So I came into it kind of cold in a way, I got a plot from you know, from Ron, the first issue. And then I got the second issue plot in two stages. And the second half of the plot was really a long time coming, because I think they had to coordinate whatever was happening with all the other convergence things. So that's again why at the end I was like so jammed, just trying to do my stuff. So I don't really know what the whole thing of convergence is. Only like my two issues were basically they had to fight the Kingdom Come heroes,
okay.
Which you know a lot of the fight was sort of like kind of off camera, so they could concentrate with the. Well, I mean, you've got what, like 14, 15 characters. You know, that alone is a lot of work to try to stage that stuff. But then you can't have individual fights between 14 and 15 people because, well, you'd need like 5 books. You
know, right. So. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
We can want it, and then we just can't have it.
Right, yeah. And then, you know, I guess, seems like most people didn't like what I did from what I read online, but that might just be the internet. So well, the internet hates everything.
Yeah, that internet. Like the ones who don't like something will let you know right away.
Well, you know, that seems to be the case. I know even with one of the negative aspects of the internet, is that I know that for instance, the message board on Comics Kingdom, there's people who basically go there every day to, I guess, make fun of the characters and to make fun of me and to make fun of the writer Woody Wilson. And it's just like the same, if I go there every once in a while, or I might go to there because I want to pull down an old script to use for, you know, the match reference or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You read these comics and I'm thinking like, wow, there are people who actually go to read a comic strip every day and like to throw eggs at it. And I'm thinking like, there's a lot of stuff I don't like. A ton of stuff I don't like. But I wouldn't go to somebody's website every day to go, you suck again today. Bye.
Well, hey. You know, just at least they're reading it.
Yeah. Well,
you wonder if they're reading it. I don't know. It's very bizarre.
Yeah, there is that concept of paid trolls too that are paid to do that in order to drive up page views. Unfortunately,
yeah,
you never know.
Well, every message board I've ever been part of, you know, going back for years, eventually ended up in like huge flame wars just because the trolls would get on there and like I guess they're just people who that's what they love to do. They just love to like get their flamethrowers out and just go at each other all day.
Right. So going from flame wars on the internet to something I think is probably a little nicer. Didn't you just have an art show?
I did have last week I was in.
Mm-hmm.
Canco, Pennsylvania, taking part in the Canco plein air, which is a week-long plein air painting, which basically means painting outside, painting event, which was a lot of fun. And like I said, to me now, at this stage, even though I still love comics and I really like doing comics, I'm much more creatively fulfilled of being a painter and working on my own paintings. I find that a lot more challenging than comic at this point. And so I'm trying to do more and more of that. But yeah, so I was out there with a bunch of friends of mine and painting. It's out near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. So we were out there, doing that. And so yeah, I mean, when I'm not, I try to do that as often as possible.
Mm-hmm.
with my other, deadline. I mean, all the years of drawing when I went back to school, all the years of drawing comics, all the years of drawing definitely helped, you know, with painting and, you know, vice versa. I mean, both things inform each other. So, you know.
Right. So mm-hmm. what would you say you spend more time doing? Penciling an issue of a comic book or working on one of your paintings?
Well, probably now I spend more time still doing comics.
Oh, okay.
Because comics pays the bill, you know, so. Like I had to really double down that week that I was out there painting. And in fact, a couple of nights I was actually working until 5 in the morning and I catch like 3 hours sleep before I ride out to paint because I had to make sure that I got the scripts in that week. So, you know, it's always, it's, you know, jumping around like today, tomorrow I'll finish this week's Judge Parker scripts, daily scripts that I have to try to do. I want to try to do two Sunday scripts to catch up and get a little bit ahead. I do that for a couple weeks because then I'm going to be working on my new comic. But then I also want to go out and do painting. But I'm always jumping around. And the nice thing about that is that you never get too bored by doing one thing.
Right, right.
Which what I've always enjoyed in my career was doing different things. So I like doing animation and I like doing comics. I like penciling stuff and I like inking other people's work. So, you know, I never wanted to do just one thing. I have large appetites as an artist and I like to do a lot of things.
Okay. So as we're coming near the end here, something I've been trying to ask our guests more and more is, how do you measure success?
Well, I think that's an individual mark.
Yes.
I think when I was younger, I thought, and it's probably still that way to a great degree. I mean, my success is being able to support myself as an artist, which I've been doing since, you know, I was 22 years old working at Marvel. So that's one form of success, is being able to, you know, feed yourself and buy a house and a car. And then the other success is having your skill, having the skill. So, you know, I still want to be as good as all the people that I admire and still admire. Now, there were people I admired as a teenager, you know, all the great, Marvel guys and, you know, Kirby and Wood and Williamson and DeSema and Kane and Neil Adams and all that whole great era of stuff. And then I also admired the golden age of illustrators, you know, Rockwell, all the way back to people like N.C. Wyeth and Howard Pyle. And so now my measure of skill is probably more, or satisfaction or success is more focused on painting than comics, partially because I've already achieved, you know, a long amount of success within the comic business. And I'm still trying to push my skill level up the hill, you know, and I think I'm more interested in doing that as a painter, even though I am still always trying to make my work better as a cartoonist. So, for me, the most important thing is to be successful as an artist. You know, I always figure, you know, all the guys I admired, all the artists I admired were successful because they were good, right?
But right.
Frank Frazetta was successful because he was like really good, you know? You know, N.C. Wyeth was successful because he was really good. So it seemed to me that if you could get really good, then you would also have success based upon the fact that you're good and people want to work with you if you're good. You know, that's one of the things I always tell my students, that, you know, there's like four levels to business, the A level and the B level.
Right.
The A level and the B level, people get to work with all the top people, work on all the best projects, do all the best stuff.
Mm-hmm.
B level is average. B level people don't ever really get to work on all the best stuff. Or if they get to work on it, you don't get to do the really cool part. You get to do the part that's left over. And you're also usually never guaranteed a very long or successful run on a project or a career. And then, you know, and who wants to go to school to be average? Who says, boy, my desire out of life and all the hard work and all the expense I have going to school, I really just want to be average. Can I just please be average? Nobody wants that, right?
Right.
Everybody wants to be good. So, that's a lifelong thing. You know, your goals may also change as you get older. I mean, my goals at 23 were to work for Marvel, and to be like, you know, John Buscema or somebody like that that I admired. My goals now at 53 are different than they were at 20.
Right.
You know what I mean? Now I really want to work on becoming the best painter I can possibly be.
Right.
I still love comics, but I would much rather work on and become a great painter. So it's, you know, if there are things that the 23-year-old me, if he was magically transported here now, would be happy with, but there would also be things they would be very surprised by.
Right. Oh no, I feel that way about myself. Yeah, too. You know, if I took the 20-year-old me and I brought him today, he would be surprised by the choices that I've made that I'm happy with. You know.
Yeah, I mean, part of the biggest difference. I talked with, you know, my friends are all around, mostly around my same age, is that the aesthetic that I trained, or the aesthetic that I aspired to, was that era of, say, mid-60s or early mid-70s, because that's the stuff I grew up reading and the stuff that I grew up loving and was exposed to. That era doesn't really exist, so you can't really do a 1967 issue of the Fantastic Four. So,
right.
You know, you have to move, you have to find a way of moving beyond that and still having some success. And, you know, that's the hard part about commercial art. As a fine artist, I'm only trying to appease myself.
Right.
As a commercial artist, I have this weird mix of trying to appease myself, appease the editor, appease the publisher, mm-hmm. appease the reader. So there's a lot more, it's not as pure or as a purely selfish endeavor as being a painter. You know, you have to please the client.
Right.
And that's always that's a dicey thing. Some people find out that they're really good at doing that, and it might happen that what they love to do is also what happens to be really popular at the moment. Or you may find that what you really love to do is like not quite in sync with the other thing. So it's like a wicked back and forth thing. And I think that I see that with students, you know, they sort of start to come to realize maybe, you know, going along in school, like, well, maybe I might not be so cut out for this or cut out for that. Or mm-hmm. maybe I may not want to do this or do that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and that's, it's good when a student can realize that. I was actually going to say to your point about A-level artists and B-level artists, I would not be surprised if you looked at the B-level artists and you'd find a lot of people who think they're really good and they don't need to learn anymore and improve. And a lot of the people in the A-level, you're going to find them most of them being people like, oh, I can always learn new techniques. I can always improve upon what I'm doing. You know, I think that's what separates those mindsets. The people who want to strive and do more are usually the people that are more successful and are more talented a lot of times.
Yeah, I think you have to always remain hungry. You also have to always remain a student.
Right.
And the main doesn't mean that you're not proud of your work, respectful or happy that you with your achievements, but you know, you realize that there's always another level to go. I think the worst thing that can happen to a young artist is to be super successful
mm-hmm.
really early without the maturity to balance that ego, because that has destroyed a lot of really good young artists. You can be hot at, you know, at 30 and crap by the time you're 40. I mean, it does happen to people. And like I said, you know, if I look at my career, how fast things have changed, let's say, post-2000, you know, things are changing every day. The cell phone and all this new technology is really driving, it's just really driving everything. It's driving all media, all entertainment, and it's not necessarily always in a predictable fashion. So, you know, you have to try to also remain flexible as you can when working in a lot of these different commercial endeavors,
right.
Because there's a upside to technology, but also a downside to technology. That whole globalization. I mean, I didn't have to worry about guys from India when I was 23. Now, yeah, there are people in India. Even I saw that happen in animation.
Yeah.
Now there are people working in animation overseas that are just as good or better in Photoshop. Anybody here in the United States. That changes the dynamics for you as a young artist, because you're not just competing with people like me or other professionals like me. You're also dealing with people that are your age or, you know, in Sri Lanka, and they will work 10 times harder for no pay.
Yeah.
They don't have any, you know, have any choice.
Yes. No, and that's true. I mean, it's unfortunately the way things are going, you know, and there's definitely a downside. I think one of the other downsides is that, you know, I mean, business sees it as a good thing, but I think it can be a downside is you can get instant feedback on things. And if enough people complain about something or don't like something, you know, the business can pull it or change it, you know, before they actually release it. And, you know, if they don't like an artist on a book, you know, they might complain about it. So the company might pull that artist, before they work on any more issues, you know? So it's good for business to get their feedback, but, you know, it could be bad for the artist who maybe had an off day on something, you know?
Yeah, I think the positive to technology is that it allows anyone now really to go out and be able to produce their own comic, their own book,
mm-hmm.
their own film, their own, you know, cartoon. That didn't really exist when I was coming up. I mean, if you wanted to make a film, and I did work on amateur films as a kid, then you had to get your Super 8 camera out and you had to do all the stuff. And it was really hard to do that. It was a lot harder.
Yeah.
Now you can use, you know, the software and make your stuff, you know, just as slick and technical as anybody else's stuff. So there's a lot of benefit for you as an artist. Also, the internet opens up at the Library of Alexandria at your fingertips. I mean, there's so much.
Oh, yeah.
That I just would have died and gone to heaven when I was 17 and had the internet now. So I think people are also kind of jaded a little bit because there's so much great stuff. So you have a lot of opportunities now. I mean, just like printing on demand, things like that. When I was starting to self-publish, it didn't exist. Now, within, you know, the last couple of years, the cost of printing stuff or the ability to print stuff, it's gone down in price, but it's also become a lot easier to do. So there's a, you know, if you're really a hungry, talented, motivated person, artist, young artist, that so many venues and possibilities for you to get your ideas or your comic or your film or your music, or whatever, out there, you know? There's a lot of crap out there, but I still think we all know if somebody puts something cool on the internet, everybody knows about it in 2 days on Facebook.
Right, yes. That is true.
You know, there's a lot of crap people put on Facebook, a lot of really, like, horrible stuff.
Yeah.
But if somebody put out something that was really good and really funny, within a couple of days, everybody will know about it on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram
right.
or whatever. That did not exist when I was coming up. So even if I had made a really awesome comic, it would have been a lot harder for people to see it.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't even have the direct market yet. So, I always tell students, it's like, I would be trying to do my stuff. I mean, I know it's fun to work with Marvel and DC, but I would be trying to work on my own stuff today and get my own stuff out there.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think that's, you know, I've talked to artists who, you know, started later than you, and a lot of them had to do their own stuff before they could even get noticed by Marvel, you know, or DC. You know.
Well, my buddy Rick Remender is a great example of that. I've known Rick, gosh, you know, way over 10 years now. Rick was a young guy that came up through the trenches, putting out his own stuff, you know, and then he was doing stuff at Image, you know, and mm-hmm. he did, I don't know how many books at Image. And next thing you know, he's a top guy writing stuff at Marvel.
Right.
That's what you do now, is you try putting out your own stuff. You hook up with a writer or you hook up with an artist. Start trying to do your own stuff. Because then if you actually get to go to Marvel or DC, I think when you get to play with those toys,
right.
you'll get to play with them maybe in a better way, you know? And still, you know, if you come up with your own Hellboy, who needs Batman?
Yeah. So, all right. Well, you know, we've been at this for, like an hour and 10 minutes now. So, I think this is a good place to put a pin in it. So before, as we always ask people, you know, before, as we're wrapping up, where can people find you online?
Well, you can go to drawman.blogspot.com. It's mm-hmm. my blog where I've been doing that for over 10 years. Mike Manley. MichaelColeManley.com. You can see my fine artwork. You can see me and Mike Manley on Facebook. Or you just, you know, type in Mike Manley into Google. you can see my Tumblr, my Instagram, my Everygram. So I'm a pretty easy guy to, I've been on social media for a long time now. So I'm pretty well used.
All right, cool. So I guess, unless John has anything else he wants to add before we call it a night?
Thanks for Secret Saturdays too. I love that one as well.
Well, you're welcome. I really liked it, and I knew Jay Steffens a little bit, and yeah, it was funny. It was sort of like doing a Johnny Quest. So that was
mm-hmm. yeah, it was in that realm.
Cool. So so don't keep your Saturday secret. And on that bad joke, ladies and gentlemen, as we say each and every week, don't let your cape be caught in the door. Have a good week.
Okay, now it's my turn. Okay, what are you doing? taking over Dad's mic so I can be part of superhero speak. Duh. Well, there are better ways to join the conversation. Really? Like what? Well, you can interact with them on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and even Pinterest. Wait, people use Pinterest? And what's Google+? I don't know, something to do with circles. Anyway, you can also see all their posts, including comic book reviews, on their website, where you can also sign up for their mailing list. Cool! Yep, are you still going to try to hijack Dad's mic? Nope, I'm going to try to answer the Stump the Geek question. Nice. So who do you think would win in a fight between Rainbow Dash and Squirrel Girl?
That's a hard one. Oh no, Dad's waking up. My feelings!
Oh, what are you guys doing? That cape's going to get caught in the door.